From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. On Saturday, millions of Afghans voted to elect a new president. The good news is turnout was strong, with less violence than the Taliban had threatened. But we don't yet know who will succeed Hamid Karzai. That could take weeks, even months. Nor is it clear what the change of government will mean for ordinary Afghans, for the Taliban, for the United States. This hour on Point, Afghanistan goes to the polls. You can join us on air or online. What sort of change will this election bring? Will a new leader work more smoothly with the U.S. than Hamid Karzai has? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Now, joining me first from Kabul is Matt Rosenberg, foreign correspondent for The New York Times covering Afghanistan. Matt, welcome to On Point.
Hi, how are you?
Matt, set the scene for us a little bit. I've seen some reporting from an Afghan news agency giving some sort of preliminary assessment showing that Ashraf Ghani had a narrow lead over Abdullah in the preliminary assessment of the balloting. Is that reliable? What do we know about what's taken place, even if we don't have final results?
Yeah, I would say it's just not reliable. There's a lot of stuff floating around. You know, outside every polling place they put up results, there are 6,000 plus polling places in the country, many of them remote. These are random samples. Nobody's waiting this for any region, whatever. So people are just collecting things. I think at this point, you know, you got to look at that and say, you know, okay, maybe it's something, but it's definitely not indicative. Going into the race, though, the presumed front runners were Mr. Ghani, Mr. Abdullah, and a third guy, Salmi Rasool, who's a former foreign minister who does not seem to have done incredibly well. But, you know, there's a real paucity of polling here. Reliable polling. There's no real way to measure right now, and it's going to be a few weeks until we really know. And I think everybody's got to be a bit cautious until then.
What was the form in which ballots were cast?
They're paper ballots. And, you know, they put in some this time. You know, in 2009, it was so filled with fraud. A number of protective measures were taken this time that were quite impressive. They're barcoded. There's a series of measures to try and make sure you just can't stuff ballots. And if anybody tries to stuff ballot boxes, they'll probably be caught. The international community was fairly involved in helping design some of these measures. And a lot of UN people and others expressed a lot of confidence that the measures were pretty good.
So when you look at sort of the situation on the street right now, has life gone back to normal? You know, there was a lot of security in place to protect the voting process that seemed to be mostly successful. Is there an aftermath to that, or is everything back to a normal Monday in Afghanistan?
It's amazing. You know, in the weeks leading up to the election, the attacks intensified. And by the week before the election, Kabul, which had really borne the brunt of a lot of the violence, was a ghost town. I mean, it was incredibly tense. There were checkpoints everywhere. You couldn't go a block or two without hitting a checkpoint. The place was increasingly deserted, and it just felt like a city that was under siege and very, very tense. Then election day rolled around. People got out to the polls early. There wasn't any violence, like huge, large-scale violence, and they kept voting. And by yesterday, life was coming back, and today everybody's back to honking the horns and traffic stalled again. I mean, I've never been so happy to be sitting in a traffic jam, I think, than today when you really looked around. This is a city transformed. Everybody's in a much better mood. It actually seems happy, which it hasn't felt in a long while.
Well, does that tell you that the security measures that you mentioned to prevent fraud, the absence of violence on the scale that many people had feared, the heavy turnout, does that tell you that whoever wins this election was a success?
Well, you know, I think we have to. It's early days yet, and there's still a lot to kind of be known about the extent. There's going to be fraud, that's for sure. The extent of it is the question, and is it enough to tip the election? Even if there is no fraud, will the different constituencies, the different ethnic groups in this country accept the results? These are big questions that we don't know yet. And even in 2009 felt much worse in the beginning, but it got a lot worse as it went on. And I think we still have to be cautious here. That turnout figure is incredibly preliminary. I know we reported it last night or this morning, and some others did as well, but there's a caveat that this is very preliminary. They haven't thrown out anything fraud or fraudulent ballots yet. Those investigations are still to be had, and we're just not sure yet. But it does look, the early signs are that there was very good turnout.
But so the figure of 7 or 7.5 million that we've seen, that's ballots cast as opposed to people counted, which is why you're saying there's a little hedge there for potential fraud?
Yeah. I think, you know, conservatively, probably push it, maybe the worst-case scenario is to push down to 6, 6.5 million, which is still far in excess of the number of people who voted in 2009. And I think that does give that doesn't just give the government a huge boost. It gives Afghans a boost. I mean, they can look now, and I've heard people say this today, 2009 was this fairly foreign-run election, and it was a total disaster. We've done this ourselves, which is mostly true, and we've done it well. People were invested in it and seem to have. And it is a pretty stark repudiation of the Taliban. In government-held areas, which is big chunks of the country, people said, you know what, we're going to go vote. We don't care about your threats and you telling us not to. We're going to vote. There were parts of the country where there was no election. There's no way around it. This is a war zone. How many of those is still yet to be determined? There were parts of the country where in 2009 and then in parliamentary elections in 2010, there was no election. There seems to have been a huge election this year. So it's a mixed bag so far, but the mixed bag is mostly looking very good. And that, I think, has the potential to set Afghanistan on a course a course correction that maybe wasn't there that puts it back on track. There's a lot of variables here, and this is one moment, but, you know, moments do count.
One question before I let you go. Do you draw any conclusions from this moment about the relative balance of power between the government and the Taliban? That is, has the Taliban lost its ability to execute on a large scale and disrupt the country, or was this just an extraordinary clampdown, or maybe they made a choice not to try to disrupt it?
I think it's a combination of all three there, and I think there's certainly the potential that this becomes a boost for the government and the people's confidence in the government, and they can carry it forward. But there's also potential, and it's something we've seen repeatedly in the past, that when something good happens, the government, which is a mix of inefficiency and criminal networks, manages to somehow not capitalize on it and go the exact opposite direction, and the Taliban then capitalize on that. That this is a very good moment, but it's just that. It's a very good moment in what's been a long, long conflict that is not yet over. We don't want to go too far and say, you know, everything's going to be great now. But that's really the feeling in Kabul at the moment and a lot of other parts of Afghanistan. And you know, I think people deserve that in some ways. They came out in large numbers, and so far, so good.
Well, that's a hopeful note to end on. Matt Rosenberg, foreign correspondent for The New York Times, covering Afghanistan. Thanks so much for joining us from Kabul.
Thank you.
Now, with me now from Princeton, New Jersey, is Candace Rondo. She's former senior analyst in Kabul for the International Crisis Group. She's now a research fellow at the Center for National Security at Fordham Law School and a master's candidate in public policy at Princeton's Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs. Candace, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
And with me from Washington is Michael O'Hanlon, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, who specializes in defense and foreign policy issues. He served in the Clinton administration. He's the author of numerous books, including Healing the Wounded Giant, Maintaining Military Preeminence While Cutting the Defense Budget. Michael, welcome to On Point.
Thanks, John. Nice to be with you and Candace.
Candace, let me start with you. Matt Rosenberg painted a fairly hopeful picture of what he said was just a moment, but positive moments have been few and far between in Afghanistan. What conclusions do you draw about what we've seen so far?
Well, I think we can say that the Afghan people's commitment to a political process is very real, and that there is certainly enthusiasm for a shift from a long past of, you know, violent conflict. This is a huge moment. It's a historic moment. We all have to acknowledge that. As Matt said, the numbers may be a little bit fuzzy in terms of turnout, in terms of who is ahead in this race. But it is clear that the turnout was much stronger than the 2009 elections, and that people felt very strongly that this was a time to make a change, and that, you know, this was also a very defiant message sent to the Taliban. And from that, I think we have to be optimistic that, you know, this is a major turning point for the country.
Michael, are you optimistic?
Yes, I'm certainly hopeful, and I would second the tone and the positive message, but also the, you know, the guarded caveats of both Candace and Matt. I mean, let me just play out very quickly one possible scenario, which is that this initial polling that we saw turns out to be roughly correct, plus or minus 10-20%, or even more error margin would still mean that Ghani and Abdullah would make the runoff. If that's the case, then whatever happens here by way of counting, by way of allegations of fraud, imperfections, the knowledge that some voting stations in the war zones or the heavy areas of violence in the south and east were shut down, all of that's not going to matter that much for determining the runoff. But it will matter a lot. All those same kinds of factors will matter a lot for determining the winner of that runoff, because Ghani and Abdullah appear to be close enough that you're going to have likely victory margin in a runoff within the margin of fraud. In other words, smaller than the likely allegations of impropriety. And that's going to be the bigger test. Now, I know I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit, but because many listeners, I think, want to know what this means, and they've already heard the good news that it was a good day, I just wanted to begin to tease out that possible trajectory. But yes, it was certainly a good day.
This is On Point. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're looking at Saturday's presidential elections in Afghanistan. With me this hour is Michael O'Hanlon, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, and Candace Rondo, former senior analyst in Kabul for the International Crisis Group. Candace, to put it down at a very understandable level for our listeners, and that is, what are the stakes for ordinary Afghans in this election process, given who Karzai is and who his potential successors are? And what are the stakes for the United States?
The stakes for the Afghan people are very high. This transition needs to happen as smoothly as possible. There are a number of tests ahead. There's a possibility of a runoff. I think that is, one of these untested moments in Afghan history that we'll have to remain to see how it plays out. But for the Afghan people, a failure to bring off this election and complete the process and hand over power peacefully could really impact certainly the economy. The international community has really lost patience with the discord, I think, that they feel that they've arrived at with the Karzai regime. Where things might have started out, I think, very much on a positive foot back in 2002 when he first came into office, it's very clear that the relationship has really deteriorated between Kabul and certainly Washington. So what's really
important, more international aid with a new government?
Absolutely. More international aid. I think also, the potential for foreign investment will be affected. And we can't really discount the importance of that because this is a country with tremendous amounts of potential economically that it just has not been able to tap into. And if you cannot transfer power peacefully and demonstrate that you're a relatively secure country, of course, nobody's going to want to invest.
Michael, who wants to invest in Afghanistan? You mentioned earlier it's a war zone. What is the economic potential of the country?
Well, Candace and I both like going there, and so I'm sure that in the long term, one would like to hope for a return to tourism. That used to be one of the industries in the 60s and 70s, but it's going to be a while before we get there. I'm sure she would agree. And, the attacks on high-profile foreign targets that we've seen in recent weeks remind us of that. So realistically, it's going to be agriculture, minerals, and possibly transportation. People talk about a new Silk Road because Afghanistan's the crossroads between South Asia and Central Europe and Iran. I think even that, though, is going to be a long shot because, of course, Afghanistan's infrastructure is fairly weak. It's better than it was. We've had some success in improving it, but it's still relatively weak. It's a mountainous country and a war zone. So I think you come back to agriculture and minerals. Agriculture is, on the one hand, a very difficult enterprise in a dry country with mediocre roads. On the other hand, you do have a billion hungry mouths just to the south and east in Pakistan and India, and some traditions of trade. And Afghanistan does have a good climate where you can irrigate. It has a good climate for growing a lot of different fruits and other things. So that certainly is one area. And obviously, it's also the main source of sustenance for the average Afghan individual who lives in the rural zones. And then, of course, there's all this talk of trillions of dollars in mineral deposits that initial credible geological surveys have uncovered, but it's going to require development of those assets. And we've seen a Chinese mining company willing to talk about a contract for copper, and one or two other things are being discussed, but it's been slow going, largely because of the security environment. Some people resent the Chinese interest. I say I'm all for it. You know, anybody who wants to invest in Afghanistan, Chinese, Russian, American, Canadian, South African, Brazilian, you name it, Afghanistan needs that interest, needs that investment. And as Candace has mentioned, it's going to be crucial as foreign aid diminishes. So I don't think we can be too picky about who comes in. I just hope that that mineral wealth is something that can be tapped into at least by, you know, mid to late decade.
Michael, you wrote a book called Toughing It Out in Afghanistan. What about the United States and our effort to tough it out, to make a security agreement with the Afghan government that would allow some troops to remain, which I believe is the preference of the U.S. government? Karzai hasn't been willing to sign it. What are the stakes for the United States, for our military, and our posture against terrorism?
Well, I had the honor of writing that book with an Afghan woman who really has toughed it out. She returned after the overthrow of the Taliban. She'd actually been trying to set up girls' schools even before, during Taliban times. Her name is Hasina Sherjan. And she is one of the reasons why I think Afghanistan has hope, because you've seen this diaspora, this international community of Afghans who had left the country but have in many cases returned. And of course, you had a lot of Afghans who never had the chance to leave or just became refugees over the border in Pakistan or Iran and who are now back. And so, yes, we've had to be patient. We've had to tough it out. But the Afghan people have been extraordinary in what they've been through ever since the 1970s and are now finding a way, as we saw Saturday, to show some hope in their own future. For the United States, it's going to be a modest amount of effort. And the good news is I think any plausible Afghan president would sign that agreement, that bilateral security accord that would allow legally for American and then subsequently other accords would allow for other international troops to stay past the end of this year. The Afghans are still going to need some help. It can be much less than before, less than 10% of what it was at peak, but it's still going to be necessary.
Candace, Mike talked about hope. I want to play a piece of sound and get you to talk on the other side. NPR's Renee Montaigne spoke with an 18-year-old woman outside her polling place in Kabul. She was undeterred by threats of violence. Here's what she had to say.
I was concerned that it couldn't make me stay home. And I really wanted to vote for Dr. Abdullah, I must say. I really love him, and I voted for him.
Candace, that's a lot more positivity about an election process that you often hear in the United States. What do you think the mood of the country was going into this election?
I think people were, you know, I think they probably had mixed feelings, to be honest with you. Certainly in the rural areas, I think there probably was a great deal of fear. The Taliban had been threatening to disrupt these elections. And I think, you know, when we come down to it, the analysis will show that in those rural areas, that's where they did disrupt the elections and that they were quite successful on some level in intimidating people. On the other hand, in the big cities like Kabul, like Jalalabad out east, certainly you would have seen a great deal of enthusiasm, as you heard there with that clip. For women in particular, you know, the stakes were so very high. They continue to be very high. This transition will very much impact their ability to keep moving forward, to progress politically, economically, to take part in the process. So at the end of the day, though, I think as the day went on and people could see these massive lines of, you know, Afghans standing peacefully, quietly, waiting their turn, that must have been a huge boost for the entire country.
Our number here is 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. We've got Eric on the line from New Orleans. Eric, go ahead. You're on point.
Hello, John. It occurred to me following the reports, the preliminary reports of the election results, that the Taliban really I mean, their best strategic move is just to bide their time, try and disrupt the elections a little bit more. It's just to kind of like, hey, we're still here. And then wait till the pack is narrowed down to, it looks like, two front runners. I mean, they're a suicide bomb away from demoralizing the population and making them believe that the democratic process is never going to work. I mean, I'd rather not have that opinion, but it would seem like, I don't know, I expected a little more bang for them from the Taliban to try and disrupt this election. I know there were a number of bombings and tragedies that occurred, but it seems like they're biding their time.
Eric, thanks for your call. Michael, one suicide bomb away, Eric said. Does that tell you that nobody should, especially with a potential for a runoff, nobody should take too much satisfaction in the lack of violence so far?
Well, it's always good to be nervous in this kind of a situation, and I commend Eric's hesitancy at getting too celebratory just yet. But the Taliban did try to attack on Saturday. There were 150 incidents nationwide by the numbers that I've seen, and that's a lot of attempts. But the good news is it's a lot fewer than the last time around. In fact, this time the Afghan army and police were securing all these sites, manning the checkpoints. The coalition did very little, and yet we saw the Afghans hold the number of incidents down by two-thirds, because there had been about 500 incidents a day in both the 2009 and 2010 elections when international forces were in the lead in providing security. So the Taliban tried. Now, it's true. You always have to worry about that one attack. I don't know if Eric's implication was that suicide attack could even take out one of the top two candidates, and certainly that would throw things into a huge disarray. But I think we've already seen the Afghan people are actually resilient enough that the random attack is not going to stop them from supporting the process next time around. And so on that point, at least, I'd be a little more hopeful than Eric.
Candace, I want to play one other bit of sound. That is, on Sunday, the former finance minister, presidential candidate Ashraf Ghani, used to work for the World Bank, said in an interview with the BBC he worries that a runoff election, which will happen if nobody gets more than 50%, would attract corruption. Here's Ashraf Ghani.
There has to be a clear winner so we can say the public give us a mandate. Negotiation behind the doors is going to deprive the public of the voice.
Candace, you agree with that?
I agree that this will be the first time that Afghanistan has had to hold a runoff. If you remember, in 2009, Abdullah came close when he had the runoff planned with Karzai, but then decided to step back from that. This time, we will not see either candidate. It doesn't matter really who it is, actually, whether it's Abdullah or some of the other candidates who are still in the race. This time, we can't step back, primarily because the Constitution calls for Karzai to step down. So, yes, the incentives for fraud in the second round will be much higher. I think the incentives for violence, targeted violence against the two candidates who will end up in those slots, as your caller pointed out, I think it will be very, very high. And we already saw, of course, during the campaign, Abdullah Ghani, a number of other candidates, but those two in particular, they weathered a number of major attacks. And we have to remember that it's not just the Taliban that's in the mix here. It has to be understood that the ethnic divisions that have come up in the country, that have gotten stronger over time, are going to play a big part in how violence plays out, how corruption plays out in the final round.
Candace, is there a significant difference among the leading three candidates in who is more pro-Western or anti-Western than the others? Does the fact that Ghani used to work for the World Bank tell us that he would be and studied in the United States, that he would be more friendly to the United States?
Well, I think all three of the top contenders, Mr. Rasool, Abdullah, Mr. Ghani, all three of them, have a very long history of strong relations with the West. All of them have spent time in the West at various points. You know, they're very well educated. They understand the stakes, you know, in terms of the relationship between Kabul and Washington and other international capitals. I don't think you can say that there's any distinctive difference. I'm not certain that that is the question we should be asking, though. More important and perhaps more relevant for Afghanistan's future is how do they play vis-a-vis Pakistan? How do they play vis-a-vis Iran? We have to remember that, you know, Afghanistan is situated in a very tough neighborhood. And the two neighboring countries, Pakistan and Iran, have an enormous amount of influence over the political process inside Afghanistan. And we certainly should expect that there will be, I think, some considerable investment on the part of parties in Pakistan and parties in Iran in terms of how they want to influence the outcome of the second round of this election process.
Now, Michael, I want to ask you about a third candidate, the candidate who was believed to be closest to Hamid Karzai, Zalmay Rasul. He, in the, as Matt Rosenberg said, not too reliable initial surveys, exits, whatever you want to call them, was seen to be in third place. Does that tell you anything? And how popular or not popular is Hamid Karzai as he leaves office?
On the latter point, Karzai is still popular by any tally or poll that we've seen. Not only did he win election twice, of course, he had the power of incumbency, but he continues to be popular by most measures, most other measures that we can see among the Afghan people. There's certainly resentment in some quarters as well, and maybe there's a combination of popularity and anger, not unlike how Americans sometimes feel towards their own leaders, but even more intensified in the case of Karzai because, of course, he is essentially the father of modern Afghanistan. And so he's both the embodiment of Afghanistan's new hope and new effort to become a modern state, but also the man who hasn't achieved as much for the population as many would have liked. So I think the emotions about him are generally favorable but complex. On the issue of Rasul, you know, I think the first thing to say is to reiterate Matt's point, we really don't know and we're going to have to be pretty careful. But if the polling numbers are anywhere close to what we saw yesterday, and that would be consistent with pre-election polling, then Rasul is going to lose. He's going to come in third. He's not going to make the runoff. And that says a couple of things, but most importantly, perhaps, that all of our suspicions and worries that Karzai was going to somehow steal the vote for Rasul may have been wrong, or at least that Karzai may not have had enough power to do that within the rules that he was willing to play by. I think,
Michael,
you know, Karzai – go ahead, John.
If Karzai is popular, why wouldn't the same factors that led him to not sign a security agreement, status of forces agreements with the United States, play on whoever succeeds him?
Well, Karzai is different. He's in a whole league of his own because of his role in modern Afghanistan. And I also believe that Karzai, you know, he now views himself as a person who can go head to head with the international community. He's got the international prestige, the stature. He also has accumulation of resentments against the Obama administration in particular, but more generally. And so he just plays by a different set of rules. But I think even he knows, and certainly the top three contenders all know, that in the absence of foreign help, they are at risk of succumbing to the same forces of internal disarray and collapse that afflicted the Soviet-installed government in the early 1990s. And
Candace,
none of them
do
want
you
that.
Agree with Michael that there's no doubt that the successor to Karzai will sign an agreement with the United States that will allow 10, 20,000 troops to remain in the country?
Well, I don't see 20,000. I don't think that's realistic. I don't think it's even necessary. And I don't think the levels really matter. It's actually a very highly symbolic force on some level, in so much as they won't be able to, you know, get out there and lead operations so much as support them. But it is, I think, possible that both candidates, all the candidates in the running, will probably sign this agreement.
This is On Point. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking the presidential election in Afghanistan and what it means for the future of the country. With me this hour is Michael O'Hanlon, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, and Candace Rondo, former senior analyst in Kabul for the International Crisis Group. And joining us now from Chantilly, Virginia, is Sanzar Cocker, Afghan businessman and chairman of the Afghanistan Holding Group, a business services organization based in Kabul. He planned to vote by absentee from the embassy in Washington, but was unable to when absentee voting was unexpectedly suspended for this election. Sanzar, welcome to On Point.
Hi, John.
I want to play for you a clip from a member of the Afghan parliament, Shukri Barakzi, who said in an interview with the BBC over the weekend that voter turnout in the election showed the Taliban has become marginalized, and get you to react on the other side.
The turnout of the people was a big slump on the face of Taliban and the enemy of democracy in Afghanistan. People show how great they are and how they are democracy lover. And to be honest and sincere, everyone was surprised by the turnout of the people because I believe this was a kind of reaction against all the violence which is Taliban met.
Sanzar, you agree with that?
Yes, well, I think this is a case of, expectations were very different. There was a long string of complex attacks leading up to the election. Two of them actually were in the immediate vicinity of our offices. And all of those attacks left everyone really fearful that the 5th of April would kind of be a doomsday rain of attacks. And everything was just leading up to this one day. But instead, right now, there's this phenomenal sense of pride everywhere. And it's almost this giddy sense of excitement that we've accomplished nearly double the turnout of the 2009 election, in spite of the threats, in spite of horrible weather. But we should also keep in mind that there were many small-scale attacks around the country. 23 people died, mainly security forces. But the case is that it's paled in comparison to the expectations of how bad it would have been. So everyone's just happy that it turned out so well.
On your point about small-scale attacks, we've just seen crossing the AP wire a story out of Kandahar saying that an Afghan official said a roadside bomb has killed at least 15 people in vehicles diverted from a main road after an earlier attack. So your point is well taken. To what degree are you hopeful that a potential runoff can be conducted with a relatively low level of corruption and violence, which were some potential signs or conclusions, preliminary conclusions that were reached about this weekend's voting?
Well, I mean, it's always good to be positive, but if you just look at the numbers so far that have been provided, they don't necessarily add up. Keep in mind, there hasn't been a census in the country since 1979. So there's even dispute about population figures from 25 million to 35 million for the country. But if we use the generally accepted figure, about 31 million, and that about 50% of the population is under the voting age of 16, that means there's about 15 or so million eligible voters. And if you look at that number and then compare it to the Election Commission, they've claimed that there's about 12 million registered voters, which is very, very difficult to accept that you have 12 million out of 13 million people that are registered to vote. There were 15 million ballots printed and distributed to 6,423 polling stations. 961 of them were closed because of security concerns, so only 5,462 were left open. Matt said earlier that the Election Commission was very, very quick to say that 7 million people voted. And so it's very, difficult to see how 7 million people can vote looking at the polling stations, how many people could show up. But that's where the 58% number comes from in terms of turnout. 35% male, 65% female. I mean, sorry, 35% female and 65% male. So looking at all these numbers, there's going to be a lot of complaints, and we have the next 2 months before the second round elections where all these complaints are going to come out of the woodwork. More and more things are going to come out similar to the last election. So I'm hopeful that it'll turn out for the best, but so far the numbers are looking very troubling.
Candace and Michael were both talking about the potential for increased foreign investment in Afghanistan. As a businessman in the country, what is your read on the immediate potential for the economy and where it's headed over the next 6 months to a year?
They're exactly right. There's a huge number of people that are kind of holding their breath for the elections, for the BSA, to see what ends up in Afghanistan before they invest or expand or grow. And some of that has already, it's lost and it's, gone elsewhere, particularly the Dubai and the Emirates. But some of it is still waiting around to see, what happens, what we can do and expand in Afghanistan. And as a businessman, similarly, we're, facing, we serve about 74 large international organizations in Afghanistan, and many of them are
you know, kind of scaling back because they're, you know, they're on government contracts in Afghanistan. But others are, you know, hopeful that something, you know, that the new administration will bring enough reform to the government and to the country to enable, you know, more investment. It's a big country. There's lots of, you know, opportunities for business and for growth, and there's a lot of hope in every sector, from mining to agriculture to services. But it really needs certainty, the most important thing. And secondly, it needs, you know, a good, comfortable, positive partner in the government.
Michael, I want to read a question from a Facebook, one of our listeners on Facebook, that's kind of a reality check to some of the talk that we've been making about the presence of American troops at the end of the war, and also foreign investment. Here's the question. Why do we have to remake every country in our image? Why rush to turn Afghanistan into a tawdry, quasi-capitalistic democracy like the one we have in the United States? Let them find their own way in the context of their history and culture and religion. Let's stop pretending we've cracked the code to human governance. We have not. What's the answer to that?
The first thing I'd say is we are trying to largely leave, and we're going to be down below the abnormally high numbers. There's no doubt that the international community's presence in Afghanistan has been, you know, way too big to be sustainable and way too big to be reproducible in most places. It has been an aberration. But let's not forget how we got here. We got here because the outside world messed this country up in a big way, starting with the Soviet invasion. That was not something the Afghans asked for. Then we, the United States, decided that defeating the Soviet Union was important enough that we would actually add to the mayhem by arming the Mujahideen. It was the morally right thing to do, but it wasn't done for moral reasons. It was done for our strategic reasons. And then at the end of the war, we did a morally wrong thing. We left with no particular effort of any type to help the Afghans create a new sense of cohesion. And they went into a predictable form of anarchy and chaos in the 1990s, which led to Taliban rule, which then led to 9/11. So I would submit that the international community already screwed this country up, and we have some moral and strategic obligation to learn from our own lessons. That's the main reason why I think we got involved. Now, you could say the Bush administration tried to heed the spirit of the question you just raised by overthrowing the Taliban and then minimizing our commitment thereafter. But that didn't work either, because we basically gave President Karzai a bunch of money and said, buy off the warlords so they'll help you keep the peace and keep the Taliban out. Well, we saw what happened. We got the corrupt warlord system back in spades, the very one that we now complain about. So when we've tried to minimize our role or leave Afghanistan, we've basically left its people to a terrible dynamic that we helped create. And then we've wound up paying the price and paying the reaper a little bit later on. So I think we're trying to get out as quickly and as thoroughly as we can. But there's got to be some enduring commitment this time, because we've learned the hard way that just leaving doesn't serve anybody's interests.
Sansar, after 8 years of George W. Bush, 6 years of Barack Obama, how do ordinary Afghans feel about the United States?
That's a very good question. I mean, back before September 11th, Americans were always considered, you know, huge heroes. Every Afghan knew that it was because America helped Afghanistan that we were able to defeat the Russians. So there was this, you know, every American is a friend of an Afghan kind of a spirit. Now, over the past decade and the two administrations, it's slowly deteriorated, and it's gotten worse and worse, where now, you know, they're always compared to, well, there were the British, we defeated them, then the Russians, we defeated them, now the Americans have tried to invade, we're defeating them, they're leaving. It's really a different tone. And that's, you know, as a result of, you know, however many it is, 60,000, 70,000 Afghans that have died in the war. Everyone, you know, has been affected one way or the other. And they're unfairly, you know, not characterizing all the positive effects, you know, from education to healthcare to roads to, you know, everything that's happened over the 10 years. They don't credit the, you know, the Americans for all of that, you know, blood and treasure that is spent in Afghanistan to get that. And instead, the Taliban propaganda that, you know, these are foreign infidels has really, you know, the everyday Afghan, that's kind of what they think of when it comes to their mind, as opposed to all the great things that have happened and been accomplished by the U.S.
Candace, what is your assessment of the breadth of the appeal of the Taliban at this moment in Afghanistan?
I think the Taliban are not a monolithic entity, so it's hard to characterize what people really believe about them. I would say generally public support is low for really the government and the Taliban because they haven't seen much in the way of delivery of services on either side. There is a sense that I think in the South in particular, where the Taliban have had traditionally a very strong pull, a very large portion of the country is under their control, that of course there would be support only in so much as many Afghans may not feel that they're getting what they should be getting from the Afghan government. I do think that some of the feelings of distrust that Afghans have today for foreigners, for Americans, is not so much necessarily a result of propaganda coming from the Taliban, although I think they're quite effective at that. It is also a sense that the United States did not listen when early on President Karzai and other Afghan leaders pointed across the border to Pakistan and said, that's your problem. That's the problem that you need to deal with. I think the distrust that Afghans have now for outsiders and for the Taliban is actually almost dead even at this stage. Nobody expects that the Taliban is going to deliver anything better should they ever come to power again. I think there is a sense across the country that the best that they may be able to do is, continue to hold pockets of the country under their control. But largely, many Afghans, particularly those in the cities, and we cannot discount the cities. They are growing by the day. The changes that have happened there socially, economically, are very, very high impact in terms of how people view this war, view this conflict. And it does make a difference because that's where you're getting messages from the Afghan media, which has grown tremendously, that actually, the Taliban are not delivering what they say they're delivering. They don't have the answers. And I think that message is starting to resonate, and I think that's why we started to see the turnout that we did during these elections on Saturday.
Michael, I want to follow up with one question before we go to a caller, and that is that if the Taliban is standing outside of this process, threatening to disrupt it with violence, but they remain having some sway over a significant part of the country, does it follow then that after the election is over, there will be some negotiation between the government and the Taliban that will result in some sort of agreement, or should there be?
Well, I don't think there will be. It's always nice to hope. And as Candace pointed out, the Taliban is many different groups. And I think some of the local insurgents who are not the ones based in Pakistan with the big infrastructure, but just the local angry, disaffected, sometimes rival tribes or what have you, some of them you could do deals with. And that's already, of course, being attempted. But the Taliban remain at a central level very committed to a hardline agenda. And so I don't think they are in a compromise spirit, nor do I envision terms that would be acceptable to the Afghan people or government. You could imagine down the road that if the Taliban feel like they've basically lost the effort because within a couple of years they see they're not going to win even after Karzai's gone, even after the international community is largely gone with its major forces, at that point they might look for a little better deal and maybe some people would take some local, mayor positions or district governorships in the eastern part of the country as long as they disband their militias and subject themselves to some monitoring. That's the best kind of possible deal. But the Taliban right now is way too overconfident and way too hopeful about winning this war to accept those terms. And the Afghan government, I don't believe, could give much more on issues like women's rights or the Constitution or willingness to have foreign presence. And so there's not really the basis for a compromise in
my mind. At this point. Okay. Let's go to a caller. Jim is calling from Canton, Ohio. Jim, welcome to On Point.
Yes, John. I disagree with your guest who claimed that we had moral high ground in the invasion of Afghanistan. As far as the Soviets were concerned, when they left, they got every last man out. They didn't stay any longer than 10 years. We've been there forever. We want to stay there forever, and they see us as far greater evil, I believe, because we. If they fight back against us, we take them away, we put them in secret prisons, we torture them forever, day and night. The Soviets didn't do that. I think they see us the way the Jews look at Nazis. It's just pure evil, the embodiment of evil, and the government where we put in their puppet Karzai, they see him as being us. They want us out of there completely.
Jim, thanks so much for your call. Sanzar, Jim says that Afghans see us as worse than the Nazis.
Well, I wouldn't, you know, go that far. I think it's not that the Russians, you know, didn't put people in secret prisons or kill them. The Russians were incredibly horrible. There were hundreds of thousands of Afghans that were slaughtered, that were taken in the night, including 52 male members of my in-laws' family that were just, you know, taken to try to, you know, kill off the entire, political head of Afghanistan in order to bring, you know, communism to Afghanistan and take and rule there. So Russian brutality and war crimes, you know, cannot be at all compared in the same sense with the United States. I think there are the Afghans that, you know, understand, you know, the basis and the reasons and coming in there. And there's, you know, there's many different opinions about going forward. But I think nowhere can the Nazis be compared to what's happening now.
And the Soviet comparison is also one that's much more favorable to the United States than Jim was suggesting?
Oh, massively. There's no comparison into that. Yes, I mean, people consider that, you know, there's these different world powers coming to Afghanistan. That's as close as where the comparison comes to, Russian, the British, the Americans. But in terms of war crimes and killings, you know, there's no comparison.
Michael O'Hanlon, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, Candace Rondeau, former senior analyst in Kabul for the International Crisis Group, and Sanzer Cocker, chairman of the Afghanistan Holding Group. Thanks so much, all three of you, for being with us this hour.
Thanks, John.
Thank you.
And you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow, the future of the GOP from Obamacare to the 2016 presidential elections. We'll talk to Ohio Senator Rob Portman and Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal. I'm John Harwood in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.